Children International is working to end child poverty around the world by giving kids access to a safe place, a team, and a path out of poverty by focusing on health, education, empowerment, and employment. About a week or two ago, I asked our audience a couple of times if they had any experience with Children International, because I'm just not familiar with the charity, and I can look it up, and it has good scores, but I just wanted to confirm that people had what kind of experiences had. We got about, maybe half a dozen emails from people who actively give to Children International, and they all gave it very rave reviews. So I haven't had experience directly with this charity, but to the extent that I know anything about it and people in our audience have, they've given it rave reviews. So with people like you, they're more than a nonprofit. They're a powerful force for change. You can learn more at children.org. Check it out.
You are listening to a free version of The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Thursday, October 27th, 2016. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. Steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America. Downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Jane McAlevey, author of There Are No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power in a New Gilded Age. Also on the program today, Donald Trump lays down the law to the so-called military experts. Ted Cruz says maybe we just don't need 9 Supreme Court justices. Jason Chaffetz back on the Trump train. Gary Johnson having a nervous breakdown. And Clinton's still vexed by emails. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Today will be, we'll have a full, front half as well as front half, but I will probably be exiting a little bit early. Today we have an impromptu bring your 3.5-year-old son into work day. Now, fortunately, he is so enthralled by an episode of Paw Patrol that he's not
Don't
even aware
spoil
that,
it.
That I'm not even
be
talking
careful.
To. But halfway through the show, I mean, my biggest concern is halfway through the interview, he's going to like, okay, this episode's over. I want another one. And Matt's not going to know how to work the thing, and then this is all going to fall apart. But let's hope springs eternal, ladies and gentlemen. Things are just getting insane, of course. We are now, less than 10 days away from... No, the 8th. So about 12 days away at this point from the election. We're going to try and continue to do programming that isn't completely dominated by this election, but it's sort of a big deal between the Senate and the presidency and perhaps even the House. It's quite possible within a couple of months we're going to see Paul Ryan either get dumped from the speakership or perhaps resign from the speakership. Who knows? It would be a smart thing for him to do. We will be talking more about this repatriation of corporate tax deal that seems to be in the work. Schumer seems to be on board with this. Clinton seems to be on board with this for an infrastructure. I spoke to David Dayen about it on Ring of Fire. I will be for this weekend. But we will talk more about that as it comes. We get closer. Needless to say, Elizabeth Warren will have a lot to say about that. I think she's already called this a big wet kiss. So, you know, get ready, because the best thing about electing a Democratic president is that we can have actually some real fights about real policy and ideological differences, as opposed to, like, we all have to just stop the crazy person from ruining everything.
Folks, big lead.
Meanwhile, let's... I can't. I don't even know where to start. Gary Johnson had a meltdown. That actually sort of tracked our interview yesterday in the Fun Half. And listen, if you're not a member, you've missed that interview. Well, it was not as sort of electric as, let's say, the Daryl Perry one, but it was pretty crazy. But let's talk about Donald Trump. He seems to be now promoting this hotel, and there's real reason to believe that his brand is in trouble. And I imagine he's a little annoyed by that. And he sees this as a twofer. I get to promote my hotel and, of course, still pretend like I'm running for president. Here he is with CNN reporter Dana Bash, and he's having none of it.
There's new audio tape of you talking about the fact that you really have relied on your popularity and the fact that people come to your events, and that helps you with free advertising. Is that what this was about?
No, not at all. This was just under budget, ahead of schedule. That's what this is. Under budget, ahead of schedule. We built a hotel that is going to be one of the great hotels of the world. Just opened today. It officially opens today. And we built it for less money than was anticipated. And we built it ahead of schedule by over a year. And if the country would do that, we would have a country that would be in much better shape than its, you know, highways. They built ways for double and triple the cost. They built hospitals.
And so to people who say you're taking time out of swing states to go do this, you say?
I say the following. You have been covering me for the last long time. I did yesterday 8 stops and 3 major speeches, and I've been doing this for weeks straight. I left there for an hour and a half. I'm going to North Carolina right now, then I'm going to Florida, I'm going up to New Hampshire. For you to ask me that question is actually very insulting, because Hillary Clinton does 1 stop and then she goes home and sleeps. And yet you'll ask me that question. I think it's a very rude question, to be honest with you. And what I do is I want to back my children. My children work very hard, Ivanka mm-hmm. in particular. And at the opening of the hotel, I want to back my children. Very important to me.
There you go.
Ivanka, who, by the way, is a tremendous piece of ass, Dana. Unlike you, to be perfectly frank.
The idea that in some way you would imply that I open the hotel in the final week of the election just to get publicity when we were already, like I said, way ahead of schedule. Didn't need to open it now. Could open it after the election. But got to have priorities. Folks, this is awesome. When we get to choose what advertisers we're willing to have on the show, this was one of the first ones I zeroed in on that I wanted on the show, because we have a real problem in my house about frames and pictures. I kid you not, there is a bag, one of those IKEA bags, full of like 30 frames that Nikki has collected that are not the right size, that she no longer likes, that it doesn't work because there's no mats to them. And it's just sitting there, supposedly to be returned, but they've been there for like 8 months. They're like this massive doorstop we have in our bedroom. Not good. Along comes FrameBridge. This is what you do. You go to FrameBridge.com. You choose your frame, or you let the designers help you choose. So in other words, you can upload your art Or you can mail your art. They'll send you a mailer. Then, if you can't figure out what you want for framing, their designers will give you four options and email you back pictures of your art framed. So you upload your photo, you know, from your computer, or you can tie into somebody's Instagram account and upload from there. You preview your photo online in the frame that you choose. It's incredibly affordable. Prices start at $39, and all shipping is free. They have a lot of quality options in terms of what kind of frames. The clean, classic frames, or like, you know, the ones that are look like that like Trump would have. They have an entire. They use premium real wood moldings, acid-free mat board, which is very important. I learned that because my sister is a photographer, and you have to have acid-free, or all of a sudden these things, they get ruined. Foam board and acrylic glazing that will never shatter and protects your piece from harmful UV rays. The expert team at FrameBridge will custom frame your item in days, not weeks or months. They'll deliver your finished piece directly to your door, ready to hang. They offer a happiness guarantee. Their team gives each item personal care and attention because meeting your expectations is as important as their own. So get started today. Go to FrameBridge.com. Use the promo code MAJORITY. You'll save an additional 15% off your first order. Go to FrameBridge.com, promo code MAJORITY. FrameBridge.com, promo code MAJORITY, as in majority. All right, let's hear Donald Trump. ISIS has now been more or less pushed out of out of Mosul, right? I mean, that's anyway. I just saw a report before I jumped on that the head of ISIS's finance has basically taken off with a bunch of cash.
I don't think this is working.
Says who?
So much. What?
Trump's special counsel, Cohen.
Michael Cohen, ISIS spokesperson. Says who? Says who we're out of Mosul. Reportedly, you're being pushed out of Raqqa. Says who?
He supposedly left with millions of dollars. Now, I don't know if that's true or not. Like, that would be exactly what you would want to sort of a disinformation campaign, but that's what's being reported. So who knows? But nevertheless, here is Trump doubling down on his criticism of the idea, like, how could you announce we're going to go to Mosul? Like, why wouldn't you just, like, all dress up like tumbleweeds? And then you just sneak up on him. Here he is doubling down on this with George Stephanopoulos.
About Mosul. On Sunday, you sent out a tweet saying that the operation was a total disaster. The defense secretary is on the ground. He says they're making progress. He's encouraged by the progress. The former dean of the Army War College says this shows that Trump doesn't know a damn thing about military strategy.
The Army War College, let me tell you, the element of surprise. I've been hearing about Mosul now for 3 months. We're going to attack, meaning Iraq's going to attack, but with us, okay? We're going to attack. Why do they have to talk about it? Don't talk about it. Element of surprise. General George Patton. You look at General George Patton, you look at MacArthur, you look at these great generals, and I say it all the time, they're spinning in their grave. We had Mosul. We have to take it because Hillary Clinton and Obama left that big vacuum, and ISIS went in and they took Mosul.
But here's the other problem.
Let me finish with Mosul. Element of surprise. One of the reasons they wanted Mosul, they wanted to get the ISIS leaders who they thought were in Mosul. Those people have all left. As soon as they heard they're going to be attacked, they left. The resistance
is... The defense says 35 of them have been taken out.
Excuse me. The resistance is much greater now because they knew about the attack. Why can't they win first and talk later? Why do they have to say 3 months before the attack, we're going in? So you can tell your military expert that I'll sit down and I'll teach him a couple of things.
There you go. I like how he almost went there.
Let's
with
talk about...
The Army War College. Okay. Yeah, never mind.
That's not exactly West Point.
Unbelievable. God. God. All right, we got to reset Paw Patrol. What's going on? Got to get another one on there? Periscope data is the ultimate tool for fast and flexible data visualization. Why run slow queries on an old spreadsheet data when Periscope data allows you to run, visualize, and share analysis over billions of data rows in seconds? Answer the big questions instead of running routine SQL tasks again and again. Periscope data is fast, powerful, and effortless to connect. Like I say, Bayesian fast query execution. You got a fast workflow, fast sharing, because you can internally collaborate, you can external share, you can embed in your app. It takes it's super easy, and it's an ease of trial. So in other words, there's no setup cost or time, and it's easily reversible. It takes one click to disconnect if you decide you don't want to move forward. It's plug and play, like I say. No uploading, there's no copying, no hassle. You can analyze data 150 times faster. Periscope data is a powerful and intuitive tool that will bring your SQL analysis to the next level. Get a free trial today by going to www.periscopedata.com/majority. That's www.periscopedata.com/majority. All right, Matt, why don't you bring that over to me? You can't figure it out. Solly, we'll be okay. How's it just going over there? You having fun at Dad's office? It really seems like it. Oh, wow. Yeah. Look at
he
that.
Looks like he's having a great time.
Yeah, this is...
Yeah,
this,
you're doing a big league good parenting job.
How about watching that same Paw Patrol again? You want to do that? You want to see Pups and the Ghost Pirate? Yeah.
Yeah, I want to see Ghost Pirate.
I don't know why that's taking so long to load, dude.
Oh, Sam.
You may have to watch the other one again. Is that okay? No? Yeah, that's a problem, isn't it? For everybody. Is there something else you wanted to watch that I don't have for you? This is too bad because this whole thing, this iPad is from like the 1950s, it feels like. All right. Okay, let's take a quick break, and we'll be back in a moment with Jane McAlevey. We'll be talking about her book, which I don't have in front of me.
There are no shortcuts.
Thank you. All right, we'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Jane McAlevey. She is the author of her latest, No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power in the New Gilded Age. Oh, welcome to the program, Jane.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So let's start with the notion of the difference between organizing and mobilizing. What does that mean?
Yeah, it's certainly the major theme of the book. If not, I think I call it my obsession in the opening chapter. Right, is trying to get people in the U.S. to understand this distinction. So I think to sum it up, mobilizing is something that all good organizers have to do, and mobilizing is a component of what I think of as organizing. But the differences matter a great deal. Organizing is about what I call base expansion. It's about bringing people who are not yet convinced that they should be part of a movement, who don't wake up in the morning thinking they're part of a movement, who don't self-identify at all as progressive or liberal or anything to the left of that, you know, who are sort of ordinary people, who are out there in this country, either being bombarded by Fox News or something else, and who are not yet part of something. And organizing is the process of how we actually expand the base of people who come to see themselves as being part of a common movement, who come to realize through what I call a process of self-discovery. I think organizing, which is always face-to-face, it's not Twitter, it's not Facebook, it's not a whole bunch of these things that we're over-relying on right now, which are mobilizing tools. We'll come back to that in a minute. So organizing to me is a process of what I call self-discovery. It's where people come to the conclusion themselves through reflective conversations, through face-to-face, one-on-one conversations, that there's something wrong, and that they can actually do something about it. And mobilizing is once someone has made the decision, aha, this pain I'm feeling in my life from the last recession or the recession before it or the pain that I have been born into in this country as someone in the working class or poor, for God's sakes, in the U.S., in the middle of the winter, in a city where it's cold and you can't get heat on, you know, mobilizing is what happens once people have come through a process of self-discovery about what's wrong and who's to blame. Mobilizing is what we do once people are with us. We mobilize them. We mobilize them right now to turn out in the election and vote. We mobilize them to come to Occupy Wall Street protests. We mobilize them to take action and do something. But mobilizing assumes the already converted. And the large argument I'm trying to make in the book, essentially, is that for about my entire lifetime, for about the last 40 years, we have been primarily mobilizing in the U.S. We have been mostly talking to the already converted, mostly talking to the choir, mostly trying to gin up smaller and smaller numbers of people to take action. And frankly, it's insufficient. It's not working. It's not going to work. And for us to make really substantial gains again in this country, like we made during the heyday of the original labor movement in the 30s and 40s, and like we made during the civil rights movement, we actually have to look at the lessons of what people were doing in those two movements and then return to them. It's what I call sort of back to basics organizing. And we just, frankly, do very little, if any of it, at this point in the U.S. in the movement.
All right. I want to get to what some of those lessons are. But what are the challenges today? I mean, I guess the most obvious challenge to organizing as opposed to mobilizing, and in some ways it seems like mobilizing has been made easier and organizing has been made more difficult because of the way our society has changed, both in terms of the way that we work and both in terms of the way that we socialize.
Yeah, I think that's right. I wouldn't deny that the challenges are stiff right now. Although, on the one hand, let's focus for a minute on this topic of sort of how technology and people sitting at home and the advent of the TV and all, you know, and disaggregated communities and suburbs. Like, let's not lose that very real challenge. But I do just want to posit that that there are things that are considerably easier. For example, in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, at the heyday of the powerful trade union movement in this country that created the context that lasted for 40 to 50 years, it took them a long time to undo it, but, you know, people were being shot and killed. And in the civil rights movement, people were being shot and killed. So, I mean, and it's not that, you know, black teenage men get shot and killed when they walk out the door today. That's a constant, but not necessarily as a result of their decision to take action in a movement, right? It's because our society has got massive structural racism that we have not yet tended to in terms of violence of all kinds. But sticking to the challenge, so I think it's true. People will frequently say to me, yeah, but like things are different. You know, workplaces aren't huge and big factories anymore. And so let's just take that one for starters. And then let's talk about the suburbs and let's talk about technology. I feel like each one of them, if you're an organizer, which is what I am fundamentally, they're just challenges. They're actually not obstacles. So the question is, what are the challenges in front of us and how do we overcome them? There have always been, when you're doing real organizing and you're really getting ordinary people to come to a new understanding of what the oppression in their lives is and why they and their families are sort of having a rather miserable lot right now. That work is always hard, by the way. It's never been easy. So the challenges just change in different generations. But I'm arguing the fundamentals of how we have to do the work really don't change, and unfortunately they have changed. So let's take the workplace. It is true that we no longer have these sort of like, well, someone will refute this right away, but it's true. Let me just say it's true that we have less big factories
right
in northern industrial cities. It is false to say we don't have big factories. In fact, the U.S. South is littered with big factories, whether they're car factories, foreign transplants, right, the attempt at VW, BMW, I mean, Toyota, Subaru. We could go through the states and list where giant plants are. What those plants have done is relocated from what were once sort of union stronghold states and gone to the global south within the global north, which would be the U.S. South, right?
Right.
And one of the examples I talk about in the book, you know, is a giant factory with 5,000 workers in it in an incredibly repressive environment where the workers win, and that's a recent fight. So it isn't impossible to win. The question is, what's our approach? What's our strategy? What's our method? And so first off, we actually do have a lot of large workplaces, and we have very strategic ones, from warehousing that the Walmarts of the world rely on to whoever it is. There's a lot of just-in-time production. I mean, I could make an equivalent argument about the strategic sectors that we're just ignoring, including the entire U.S. South, that even the Walmart campaign had been focused on sort of these associates, you know, who are people who get hired short-term, whatever.
Right.
Where the focus of that, the organizing of Walmart needs to be in the warehouses and in the production and shipping departments, not in the
retail.
Yeah, so it's just, you know, it's like, again, it's just, to me, I mean, part of what I'm trying to raise in the entire book are questions of power and strategy, right? At the end of the day, I'm trying to raise fundamental questions about power and strategy. And if you want to talk about power and strategy, then I'm arguing you have to talk about something that people don't understand very well, which is this distinction between mobilizing and organizing. So back to the challenges. Okay, so then there's suburbs, right? So one of my first organizing jobs, not when I was still a community organizer, but when I switched over and began to work full-time as a labor organizer, you know, one of the very first campaigns that I ran was an explicit challenge by several trade unions who said, suburbs are turning red. We're not having any luck organizing in the suburbs. You know, we think unions might work in big cities, but not in, you know, northern big cities still, maybe, but not in suburbs. That's about circa 1996. And so I was like, great, that's a big challenge. Let's go right at it. And so I was assigned to go work in big, wealthy suburban areas. And what happened? 3 years later, we had record organizing wins, not just because of me, by the way, but because I was working with a team of really good organizers. I had unions that were open-minded about shifting how we thought about strategy. We began to think very differently about how we had to bring different forms of power to bear in the fights themselves. And that's what I eventually call the whole work organizing method. But that, yes, the conditions are difficult now, that with workers, less workers in unions, we have to be creative about how do we actually build other forms of power that will hold during a tough fight with a tough employer. And in Stamford, Connecticut, and the areas surrounding, you know, Connecticut, posh sort of suburban region with pockets of cities, in fact, we organized thousands of workers in just a few years by thinking carefully about what did it mean to be in the suburbs. Maybe it suggests a strategy shift from being in a big factory in a northern city, right? So
what was it? Can you be, I mean, were there sort of like, I guess, transferable principles?
Definitely.
Okay, so give me just a sense of those, because this I find, you know, this is the, I would say the single greatest excuse, I guess, of why union organizing has been hurt has been this sort of decentralization of the people who are supposedly to be organized, I guess. So what are those sort of those principles? Because, I mean, presumably, right? I mean, this wouldn't just be for labor organizing. It would be for any type of organizing.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, one is let's be strategic and smart. And this is hard for people who are liberal and progressive to do, actually, which means you have to think carefully about the social structural conditions, and you have to think about where can we get the biggest bang for the work that we're trying to do? So it might be that greengrocers, that people, that there are, look, there are tons of workers in this country need a union, period. And they need a strong house of faith, and they need a bunch of things right now, right? Because we are really in a bad way. Just as a sidebar, like, part of what I think the punditry misses on the sort of liberal side a lot is that people are really hurting in this country. And people say to me, why are people thinking about Trump, Jay? And it's like, when's the last time you left the comfort of your cool little Bay Area or New York City home and went out into the country? People are hurting really badly right now. So I say we have to focus on places where we have more strategic possibilities. So, for example, I do think we have to focus on warehousing, where there's huge numbers of workers, on big factories in the U.S. South, all that. Like, there, any place there's large numbers of workers should be a strategic focus, period. So that I partly argue in the book that a key strategic front right now remains sort of the factories of today, which are hospitals, the healthcare sector, the education sector, where there is some work happening, you know, sort of at the university level, we see some adjunct movement happening, but not enough. But so, first of all, I say, let's look at where there are still large numbers of workers, and let's be clear that we probably have more possibilities where they exist. In fact, it's a cornucopia of possibilities out there right now, right? We have, I mean, I've just been involved again in a huge campaign to organize a bunch of hospital workers in Philadelphia. It's been a wildly successful campaign. It's ongoing. It's still happening. And so to me, the lessons have never ended. Every place that people are doing the work the way that we should do it, real organizing work, we're still winning. So the lessons, the principles are this. One, for starters, and this is a challenge to some people in our movement, the first principle of the work is you have to genuinely, and this is going to sound stupid, but I'm so serious about this. You have to genuinely, seriously believe that ordinary people have the capacity to do extraordinary things in campaigns and in their lives. And if you wake up in the morning and you have a slightly elitist attitude and you think, you know, I just need to get the right story and I need to create narrative change by finding the perfect worker with the perfect story about something and her kid and her something and she works so hard and now she's here and, you know, but I'm going to actually go, me, the senior staff person, I'm going to go and be the wizard who fixes all the problems in her life. That's not going to work because she's going to see through you in about 5 seconds. So part of the problem is, part of the principle of real organizing is people doing the work, we actually really seriously believe that ordinary people have real capacity to think, to change, to really change fundamentally how they understand the world. So that's principle number one, and it really matters. And I have been around workers in campaigns who have said to me, because I'm usually in some senior role, I don't even want to talk to that person again about some new organizer who's come on the campaign, because the worker understands in about 5 minutes whether or not the person that they're engaging is taking them seriously or not. So one is, do you really have faith and belief in the capacity of ordinary people? That's principle number one. Principle number two is, when you look at a person that you're having an organizing conversation with, do you see them as a worker who you relate to from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m., or do you see them as a whole person with complicated, rich, textured lives, with connections in their own community, with connections in their workplace, with connections to their family and friends, to other people in the community? And do you understand that the fundamental role we have right now, given the challenge of suburbs, desegregation, technology, et cetera, is that every act we take every day as organizers has to be about building solidarity between human beings? Like, the single biggest focus of our work every morning we wake up has to be, how today am I going to construct new relationships of solidarity among and between the workers in this facility and among and between the workers in the facility and their broader community? Because we have to be really intentional about constructing solidarity that more organically existed in the 30s and 40s, in some places, even that's complicated, but in some places. So, for example,
we should just say, just so that people can sort of catch up here, that when we say it was more organic, it was because they either came from the same immigrant community, people living together in closer quarters, or there was just a lot more social cohesion, right? Whether it was, I guess churches or the existence of unions in themselves, or working in the larger factories. There's a whole set of, that's what we talk. That's the flip side of the challenges that we're talking about.
Yes, yes, and again, so that, definitely. And let me just say an example. Partly, I do think that there's just some myths. For me, I guess it's too easy to say that we've changed that much. I hear it. I entertain it. I believe it. Some of the people I've been working with recently in some of these big campaigns have said, "Well, when I started, the idea of saying." What I want to do is now chart every relationship that 5,000 workers that we just helped form unions in these hospitals. I want to now figure out what are all their social connections in the community, because we understand all their work connections really well. And even some people in the recent process were like, okay, well, they're nurses, they're more middle class, they don't have that many connections to the community anymore. The truth is, it's just not true. And I always just say, sure, yep, sure, so let's just try, right? Sure, that's no problem. Let's just try. And then the minute we start talking to the workers, it turns out they're attending the most powerful black churches in the city of Philadelphia. They have connections all over the place. To some degree, it's true. To another degree, I'm challenging the idea of how true it is. So look at Chicago and even the Smithfield. Some of the examples I talk about in the book, the case studies, in Chicago, where you have, if you want to talk about social structural conditions, which is a power analysis, the word I prepare, coming at and against the teachers and the kids and the parents, frankly, in the third largest school district in America, the teachers there, at a time when teachers are under unbelievable blistering attack for the last, 7 or 8 years in this country, just blistering attack, everything wrong with every kid, apparently in America, is we can blame the teachers, right? That's like the rhetoric and the rap out there. We don't blame the austerity cuts made to every school. We don't blame, we don't blame all the things we should be blaming, because there's been a right-wing frame to attack teachers, right? And that has to do with charter schools and privatization, and it's all constructed. It's super real. And in Chicago, we wind up after one big teacher strike where the teachers do everything right. They did everything right. They doggedly built alliances. They systematically mapped the relationships between the parents of the students themselves, into churches and community groups all through Chicago, so that by the first time they had to do that massive strike in 2012, when I went in to sort of do a look back with them and interview a bunch of the teachers, interview a bunch of the community leaders in Chicago, it was such a pleasure for me because they did everything right. Like, they actually spent time mapping relationships and understanding the connections they had. 30,000 teachers with 420,000 students in public schools with 180,000 parents is a ton of connections.
Right.
They made them intentionally. They knew that to take on austerity and racism, they were going to have to build a really construct solidarity in a really intentional way. And that is what I mean by real organizing. We have to intentionally construct solidarity every day. And it may take a little more work to do that now because less people are in church or synagogue or whatever it is, or because less people, because there are, because Chicago isn't ringed with giant steel mills, where thousands of workers do go to work every day. But they are still ringed with big school systems, big hospitals, there's a whole bunch of big stuff still sitting around someplace like Chicago, right? So the question is, are we strategically focusing on, and even the immigrant question? I think that is more, it's more acceptable today that, look, whether it's New York City, Los Angeles, there are whole new waves of immigrants. And in fact, I have yet to organize Latino or Latin immigrants who were not deeply rooted in their community in just the way that we thought of Italians and Poles and everything else in the 30s and 40s, who are not, that's part of the story of Smithfield, that Southern factory I analyze in the new book. In fact, because of the strength of the Guatemalan Mexican community, really Mexican community immigrant workers who were undocumented in that factory, them doing massive walkouts and doing wildcat strikes in that factory was the first thing that triggered the Catholic priests in the South to say something's wrong in this factory, which then triggered the blacks to take action and the black ministers to, So it's sitting out there and we've just let it wither. Like, organizing is an active, ongoing life process, and we have just let the whole concept of constructing intentional solidarity wither for the last 40 to 45 years, and we're paying for it. We are paying for it with a lack of human solidarity right now.
Let's talk a little bit about, I guess, PSNAP or Pennsylvania, the nurses and affiliated. I don't have it in front of me, but I've interviewed a bunch of people about the Chicago strike and this idea of social unionism, I guess, or social movement unionism, which it sounds like to me is really just what you would call organizing, proper organizing on some levels, just sort of mapping these relationships. And it is, obviously for teachers, it may be a little bit easier to do that because they have a captive audience in some way, insofar as that parents theoretically are coming to the teachers because they're interested in what's going on with their students. And I guess in the context of nursing homes and whatnot, there's a similar dynamic on some level. But just talk about the sort of that this is a union that broke off from other unions and is independent, but has had a lot of success.
Yeah, a lot of success. I mean, they have a lot of success for the same reason, which is that they do real organizing work. So, in fact, part of why I had been doing some work with PSNAP is because the executive director of the union and I have, we come from the same exact training origins and the same roots, which is what I would call the old. Now, especially if you're sitting in New York, this gets confusing, right? There's a lot of acronyms, a lot of institutions, but the original or the old model of what was called 1199, when it was still a national union, many of us who are still running supermajority strikes, building really cohesive solidarity between workers and the broader community.
Tell people what supermajority strikes are, please.
Yeah, it's so infuriating to me that I have to even use the qualifier supermajority before the word strike. And that's part of my annoyance with these, what I call these less than real strikes that have been happening, that people call strikes, these protests for the last 3 years that people call strikes, which aren't strikes. So a strike by definition, I say in the book, was when a supermajority, like 90% is what we mean by a supermajority. When 90% of the workers or more walk off the job, you've actually created a crisis for your employer. You've created a crisis for capital. I now have to say the word supermajority strike, which is frustrating, frankly, because it's what a strike used to mean. But there has been this, because of the lazy fixation on the concept of narrative change, which I really am reeling against, because narrative change isn't power. Last I looked, we got a lot of good press out of Occupy Wall Street, and we haven't done a damn thing to affect what Wall Street does. So, like, narrative change is one thing, and power is actually something else. And we're getting good at narrative change, but we're not getting really good at power. So that's part of the problem. So,
and you're also talking about the fight for 15, where we had
and when one McDonald's worker or two walks out in front, and a bunch of left wing activists who everyone knows because they show up at every protest, or progressive people, which is a good thing to do. This is not a bad thing. It's just don't call it a strike. Like, when two people walk out, and then there's a bunch of good liberals who are called to show up from some Twitter feed or Facebook posting, please stand with these workers tomorrow, and there's picket signs out there, but only two workers walk out, and the store keeps functioning, and then we call that a strike. That's not a strike. It's actually not a strike, and it's a dumbing down of one of the most important weapons of the working class ever in this country. So to dumb down the concept of a strike is like what mobilizing is to organizing. It is dumbing down the actual work we have to do if we're ever going to get serious about really reversing income inequality, because it's about reversing the power inequality in American society right now. And those of us who still run what I now have to call a supermajority strike, that's where workers are still winning. Workers are still winning when they can actually create a crisis for their employer, right? When you're being trained as a young organizer, the lingo we use is like, can you create a crisis for the employer? Look, if you can create a crisis for the employer, you can actually extract wins. Workers can win good contracts, go home, and actually have enough money to pay for health care, pay for the child care bill, attend services of faith of some kind on the weekends, and have a life, and maybe have a little time for a little league game, or, put their kid in some basic sports program, right? Which is like not what's happening for most of the workers in this country anymore. So, but those of us still doing it, part of the correlation I argue in the book, you know, look, I went from being an organizer for decades to then pausing, right, to do this weird little thing, which for me was weird, to do a PhD. But in that 5 years, part of the question I was trying to answer was, you know, is my whole life experience some weird aberration, or is there actually evidence to back this up? And I'm really delighted to say there's evidence that good organizing still works. So it's hard. It requires that you are willing, as a trade union leader, or frankly, the leader of any organization, to be small-D democratic, to actually let people participate, to let them make decisions. And that is often the hardest thing for leaders, whether they're of philanthropy in this country, who's twisted a whole lot of good organizing work out there, but like philanthropists, union leadership, the people controlling the purse strings that control our movement, very few of them actually believe that ordinary people are smart enough and capable enough to make great change again. And until we reckon with that elite attitude, I mean, that's a weird thing that, like, the Trump people can pick up on, too. Like, it's really weird. But, you know, until people get over the idea that only super smart, well-educated elites can, like, solve, you know, the problems of the world, we're never going to rebuild a powerful movement. Because my understanding of the universe and my experience in this universe, and now the evidence that I went and looked at for 5 years doing a PhD, you know, comes back to the same life lesson for me, which is, I believe that with a little bit of coaching, a little bit of history lessons, and I just had this experience again working in Philadelphia, you know, that thousands of workers can club up and make really smart decisions when we teach them how, when we believe in them, when we empower them. We don't try to do the work for them. We actually teach them how to do the work. People actually are required, mass numbers of people are required to build real power and reverse the kind of grotesque things happening in this country. And the part of why I titled the book No Shortcuts, which might be stupid, but it's because I say it all the time. Like, all we've been doing since I've been a lot of what's been dominating strategies for change have been advocacy models, you know, and I dissect what's an advocacy model, what's a mobilizing model, and what's an organizing model. That's what I'm doing in this book, because I'm so frustrated by people thinking they're doing one thing and they're really doing something else, and saying they're doing something like striking when it's just a protest. So let's not confuse a strike, which has power and deep meaning behind it, and a protest. I'm all down with protests. Protests are great. We can have them till the cows come home. I'm interested in power, and a real strike is about real power. And a protest is something else. It's about narrative change in Twitter and Facebook and, you know, whatever, which it's just different than actually building real power.
What accounts for the change? The failure of leadership to maintain that tradition of organizing. I mean, what changed? I mean, why is it? Why are we in this situation now where we do? Is it simply that people get romanced by the idea of, you know, this is trending on Twitter and it must be successful? I mean, because also, I mean, to a certain extent, I mean, it seems to me the fight for 15 has had measurable success. Is that, am I wrong in that assessment? I just rolled two questions into one, but there they are.
No. But let's take the second one first. If I forget the first one, remind me in a second.
Okay.
But so let me just be clear. The answer is no. Of course, the Fight for 15 has made a contribution and done some good work. And I, as searing in my critique of the abuse of the word strike as I can be, yes, of course they've done some good work. But here's the problem. I lay out in chapters, sort of chapter one and two, sort of the more complicated pieces of the new book for me to write, which are sort of like the theoretical chapters before I get into what I like to do best, which is just analyze a good fight and tell why they won and why they lost. But in the theoretical argument I'm trying to make, it's this, and the Fight for 15 fits into this. So I'm gonna loop this back to the second question you asked of those two, which is this. Advocacy and mobilizing can win what I call the easier fights. They just can't win the hard fights. So winning a $15 an hour wage increase in a liberal city at a time of grotesque inequality isn't actually the same as changing what Wall Street does. So, or how to re-regulate the markets, or how to, frankly, how to stop and reverse climate change, or how to regulate the fossil fuel industry, or everything we've failed at doing for the last 30 to 40 to 50 years, because the planet might blow up soon, right? So it's like we have to get really serious about this. So the fight for 15, honestly, there's several things to say about it. Again, besides overall, hooray. So with the amount of money they spent, we might have done more hooraying. That's part of the issue, is how many resources are going into it. But the second question is like, the second issue for me, and it is, first of all, they're phase-ins. There's only one campaign in the country where 15 went to 15 right away and 15 mm-hmm. went to 15 with benefits, and that was the SeaTac airport campaign. One campaign. Every victory since then, we're talking about 15 in 2022 with no indexing. 15 in 2022 in Seattle is going to be the value of about $10 now. And last I looked, that's effing poverty. And no one who's running that campaign is living on that salary. So let's be real about what those victories are. And is it good in the end? Of course, any raise any worker gets is good. No question about that. But like, I actually am trying to say in the book that some of the things that we call victories are actually defeats in some ways. And, you know, even the phase-in in New York, I mean, these are, so 15 right now would get you to about 31,000. I don't know anyone who's leading any of those campaigns who's living on 31,000. Like, we're supposed to be like, hooray, jumping for joy, that 31,000 for a family of four is poverty. So on the one hand, great. On the other hand, it's really different than what the workers at Smithfield. I open up the chapter on Smithfield Foods and the victory in the Southern Factory with this dichotomy where I open up.
And I should just tell people this is a meat processing pork plant in North Carolina.
Yep, largest pork plant in the world. Recently bought by the Chinese, by the way. So, you know, in terms of globalization and the global South within the U.S. North. But anyway, so it's like I open up that chapter on purpose. Sort of poking, maybe being ironic, I don't know, poking a little punditry, something. Like, I say what 15 means in Tar Heel, North Carolina, and what 15 means in Seattle. And I do a little number comparison. Because when those workers won 15 in that factory in their last contract, and they won health care benefits, and they won the right to pull the switch in the factory to stop it when someone's getting their hand chopped off, or any of the other things that they won in their union contract, the right to retirement, the right to safety and health inspections, and 15. I start out by saying, you know, I rang up this guy, Dean Baker, who's such a good economist, just like help him do the math for me, because math is never my specialty. I can teach workers how to win good contracts, but like math, no. So, you know, to try and understand the difference between what it meant to win 15 in a rural southern community and 15 in Seattle, it's like they would have to earn, I think the number I use in the book is they would have to earn like 25 an hour right away to come close to what the workers won when they won 15 through a union contract, along with many other benefits. So, you know, again, passing a $15 an hour wage in a liberal city with a 6 to 8 year phase in, with giant loopholes about who's going to be covered and who's not, because they're all over all these laws, if you look at them carefully, it starts to be a little less exciting to me than what it means for workers who win the right to health and safety, the right to shut the plant down, the right to a real solid wage, the right to retirement, health care being paid for by the employer, and dignity on the job. That's just really different.
And there's also, I guess, what some would call the long tail of value of having organized and empowered.
Yeah.
Have the empowerment shared broadly in that supermajority, as opposed to, you know, hey, thanks, Bill. We're getting, 50,
yeah,
you know.
Exactly. Right. Someone just wakes up one day and they got a raise,
right,
and they're not really sure why or how, or, and you know, and some good liberals came in and did some work on their behalf, and that's what advocacy is. And sometimes it requires a little mobilizing, put a couple flags up and wave and make some noise, but the people themselves have not, exactly as you're saying, there's no long tail, they haven't organized. So I was just having this conversation with a bunch of workers in Philadelphia recently where, you know, I said to them, part of what's so important about the first contract negotiations phase, which is what most of the workers are in right now after these big, difficult organizing victories, is that part of what good organizers are trying to do through the process of negotiations, and this is another sort of like mini pet peeve of mine, is, you know, some people run around today saying, oh, collective bargaining is this, you know, old idea. you know, doing what they call firm-based, you know, contract negotiations is sort of a last century concept, and it doesn't help the whole community. And I say that it's just bullshit. If you've ever led first contract negotiations in your life, if you understand as an organizer that the primary job of the phase of contract negotiations is to teach governance, it's to teach the skill of building a strong worksite, it's to teach leadership development, it's to teach workers how to stand up to their employer who's sitting across the table from them and learn how to say no to them and learn how to then organize enough power to say no collectively so that when management wants to make a really bad decision like short-staffing your unit where patients might die, you actually have the capacity on your own right in that moment to fix that problem. You know, when wizards in the movement try and fix things for people, you have denied the class's ability to get smart and learn how to do it themselves. And I am all about how do we coach and teach people how to do the work. And that's what our successful movements did between the 1920s and the 1950s. We were teaching people, believing that they had capacity, and teaching them how to do the work so that when the organizer who had some capacity, some experience, all I have is experience, right? I can walk into a bunch of workers in a campaign right now and say, look, here's the thing. Based on the last 25 years of my life, if you go that way, the boss is going to do this. But if you go that way, the boss is going to do something else. That's experience. That's not because I think I'm smarter than any worker I've ever had the pleasure of doing organizing work with. I don't. I'm blown away by the smartness of every worker I've ever worked with. It's like, you know, it's just that I've done it for a long time. So I can say, and people have confidence when I say it to them, look, if you try and do X, Y, and Z too soon without first getting the full weight of your coworkers behind you, the boss is going to beat you in a month. So let's not try to do that. Let's focus on what it takes to win based on the experience of what winning looks like. That's what coaching is. That's a good coach. You know, I was saying to someone else yesterday, look, I'm a bit of a Warriors fan. Okay, I live out in the Bay Area now, right? You know, but I'm like watching the opening of the game the other night, and people talk about Steve Kerr, the smart coach. All organizers are coaches. You know, the coach doesn't get on the field. I mean, he doesn't get on the court and play with Curry and the other basketball players out here. You could do this analogy for any sport. The coach is sitting on the sidelines and figuring out how to bring out the best of every person on the team. The coach never plays. That's what good organizers do. We're not playing. I'm not the nurse in the hospitals that I've just been working with in the organizing and first contract campaigns. I'm a coach. And when organizers understand our role is to coach and bring out the human capacity that exists in people, the best, what are you good at? What are you good at? And how do we make everyone into a big team that's going to win? That's what organizing is. It's building and bringing out and coaching and nurturing the existing smarts and skills that ordinary people have.
From your perspective, why has the movement gotten away from that? If it actually has gone away, as opposed to just like a, you know, being binary. I get the sense there's been this sort of the drift away from it. From your perspective, why has that happened?
First, it's hard. It's hard. It's really hard work. That's just, it's hard. It's a lot harder than tweeting or Facebooking to actually deal every day face to face with disappointment, with all sorts of things you have to do. So, one, it's just hard work. And I think that what happened was people assumed in this country that after the labor movement in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and then after the Civil Rights Movement, you know, we won the Voting Rights Act, we won, you know, the Civil Rights Act. You can look at all the different things that we achieved as when we had movements with real power behind them that were powered by millions of ordinary people. People just assumed, like, we won things, and they thought, you know, by the late 60s, early 70s, then we passed Clean Water Act and Drinking Water, all these things, Clean Air Act. Like, people just thought, okay, we won these laws. Now we can just worry about administering them. Now all we have to do is hire a bunch of lobbyists in D.C. to tend to making sure we implement the laws that we've passed for the last 50 years, you know, in some smart way, and just keep an eye on what the lobbyists are doing. It's like a fundamental misunderstanding of, first of all, how we won all the – when we were making big gains in this country, there was a misunderstanding about how we achieved them, and there was a misunderstanding that, like, once you won a law, it just stayed, as opposed to that the right wing woke up the next day, every day, thinking, how are we going to roll it back? How are we going to roll it back? How are we going to beat them back? How are we going to unregulate the country again? So the first thing was just, like, because we don't really teach how power works and people don't – we don't spend a lot of time talking about how power really works. There's a misconception of how it works. We think we win something, and it just stays that way. Well, it's really obvious. I mean, it's finally become really obvious with the Voting Rights Act being rolled back, with voter suppression happening from North Carolina to Texas to these ridiculous laws, like even the protections from the civil rights movement are being systematically rolled back, right? So the first is there's a misconception of how of what it takes to win. The second is there's a misconception of what it takes to hold on to our power. And so that led to, I think, basically a generation of, you know, Thea Scotchpole talks about this in her book Diminished Democracy, which I quote in the beginning of my, of No Shortcuts, because I think that there's an interesting analogy to it. Like, she talks about, with lots of evidence, the sort of the explosion of, after the GI Bill in World War II, after a whole new generation of working class people went to college, people sort of went to college in the 60s and the 70s, came out, and just thought they were really smart, and they channeled all their energy into creating all these new advocacy groups and single-issue groups and an AIR group and an environmental group and a women's group and a black group and a Latina group and a something group and all, and we have, and we grew up this huge silos of individual advocacy and issue things all over this country, not understanding that it was robust class power that was also expressed in the civil rights movement, by the way. There's like a misunderstanding of how we won the civil rights movement, right? So like robust class power is what has made substantial change in this country. And it was hard, and people thought we did it. Like, they just thought we did it. Like, even Alinsky, I write about Alinsky in the new book. I mean, if you read everything that Saul Alinsky actually wrote, his core books, all three of them, most people never read his book about John L. Lewis. But if you've read all his stuff, like, he assumed, even Saul Alinsky assumed, well, the labor movements, they've got the inequality thing down. They've got strong unions. That's all set. I'm going to go out and try and build some parallel power in the community. Because I assume, he says in the book he writes about John L. Lewis, that big labor is always going to be big and strong, and they're always going to have dealt with the issue of inequality in the workplace. Well, even that was a horrific assumption, right? Like, it didn't take long for a virulently pro-business, hyper-greedy, free market capitalist system to just say, okay, it's going to take us 30 years to beat back the regulation of the working class, of the labor, you know, of the economy. And they patiently went about dismembering every law that protected workers in this country, and they've damn near done it. And then they set about doing it to the civil rights movement, and they've damn near done it, right? We're going backwards on our protection. So, I mean, it's a long way of saying I think that we have these crazy narratives that you learn in elementary school, and, you know, about how America works and how democracy works, and you vote and it's all fixed. And we're just, you know, we don't talk honestly with people anymore about how power works. And yeah. So, and I think it's much more comfortable for elites to just sit in their offices and think that they can go down to the White House and wheel and deal and cut a deal. And look how successful the labor movement's been. For 50 years, they've been trying to reform labor law. They thought they would do it again with Obama. When I was still working at SEIU in 2007 and 2008, the rap internally in the union was, all we got to do is win, you know, the White House plus 60, the White House plus 60, and then we're going to win labor law reform with the Employee Free Choice Act.
Right,
and we won the White House with plus 60. We did understand the power analysis still, and we got creamed trying to do labor law reform. We couldn't do it under Carter. We couldn't do it under Obama. We couldn't do it because we don't have enough grassroots power right now to make it actually happen.
That's as good a place as any. Jane McAlevey, it's fascinating stuff. The book is Organizing for Power in the New Gilded Age. There are no shortcuts. We will put a link to that at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Good stuff. I really can't recommend people checking out that book as... more. And I haven't, it really doesn't, I mean, there hasn't been a lot written about the book, but I think it's, there's some really important ideas in there that people should check out.
There's an odd parallel that there's this profile in New Yorker of this alt-right meme spreader, and they make the point in the article that, you know, sort of slacktivism isn't effective for the types of things that she's talking about, obviously, but it actually, it's a good terrain for the type of politics that facilitate Trump, which is a whole other sort of layer of distinguishing the organizing versus mobilizing. It's really interesting.
Interesting stuff. And there was also, I just saw, and I didn't read it actually, but I did see a piece somewhere about cautioning people that, you know, there's been too much reliance on the personnel nominated to the National Labor Relations Board. We haven't had fundamental change in union and labor laws in this country. All right. Well, we're going to take a break. Saul Cedar, can I just say that you have been very well behaved during that? Really appreciate it. Buddy, I'm talking to you. Oh, Paw Patrol's almost over? Okay. All right.
He's like, look, we.
After the. Here, do you want to come here and just tell us what's going on? After they get the boat and go back to shore? All right. Well, then you go back to watching it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's almost over.
Buzz off, old man.
Yeah.
Don't need you around here.
I'm trying to focus.
Go back to your thing that you're doing.
Go eat some yogurt. Go talk to some boring lady. Whatever it is you do.
Exactly. Have a banana. All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break. Remember, it is your support that makes the show possible. By becoming a member of the Majority Report, everybody in here, even Saul doesn't realize it, they smile. I mean, smiling now, but it's because of Paw Patrol. It's because it's Chase on the case. All right. Join themajorityreport.com. Become a member. Support the program. We will be here after the election. And, you know, as we sort of get into our dual distribution agreement with Trump TV, your support will help us make America great again. JustCoffee.coop for a drink. Coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. What else? Oh, if you buy your crap from Amazon or Jet.com, for that matter, the least you can do is give us a kickback at MajorityReportKickback.com. Number 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. The IM will be up. I think Michael will be taking over, and I'll be back on Friday. We'll be right back in a moment. He says no.